this is one of the darker episodes that we've recorded for your favorite book, not only because of the book itself, The Enchanted, which has content warnings for abuse, sexual abuse, child sexual abuse, death penalty, basically every content warning I can give you for this book, but also because we touch on some really heavy topics. We talk about an international conflict that the United States was heavily involved in, and towards the end there is also a brief discussion of abortion. These are topics right now that are very much in our news today due to the ending of the long-standing war in Afghanistan and along with some recent legislation in Texas. We've recorded this episode prior to those events taking place, but I come to you now with the understanding that these topics evoke a lot of strong feelings in all of us, and these may be feelings that you're not ready to think about right now. Maybe you're fatigued, or maybe this just isn't the right moment in time for you. So let this be my warning to you that if you're not ready to step into these spaces, that's completely fine. But for those of you that do want to engage in this content and in this episode, I hope you find it very much worth your while. My guest is a wonderful, brilliant woman with so much to say, and the conversation we have surrounding these books is absolutely amazing. Welcome, one and all, to your favorite book. And this week's guest is Ari Honavar. Ari, how are you today?
I'm doing very well from San Diego, California. It's a beautiful day.
I'm really jealous. I mean, I feel like in San Diego, I feel like you rarely have a bad weather day. It's nice for us out here in Chicago, but those days are few and far between.
Right. It's just the fires have become more prevalent in the past several years. So we do have, you know, terrible fires. But other than that, everything is great.
I don't know how I missed the fire. Somehow I always think of that as a more of a Northern California thing, but you're right. That's a statewide issue. Yes. And definitely not great weather if you think of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Ari, I'm really excited to talk to you today, not only about your upcoming book, but also about the book you chose for this episode, which is The Enchanted by Renee Denfeld. We've got a lot to talk about there. But before we get to all of that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Sure. I'm the founder of Rumi with a View, and that's dedicated to building cultural bridges and music bridges across war-torn and conflict-ridden borders. Mm-hmm. As part of that, I have a Drop Poems, Not Bombs, where American musicians, very talented, amazing group, put a line of Persian poetry into music in Farsi. They learned the language in Farsi, and they sing it to the people of Iran to create cultural bridges because of our diplomatic relations. There's always strain in there. And I dance with refugees and asylum seekers on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. And that's another building of cultural bridges. And I have a Rumi's Gift Oracle Card deck. And that is kind of taking the Western tarot and the Eastern tradition of divination that's been part of my culture for forever, putting it together with image cards that have embedded Rumi's poetry in them, and also translations and meditations.
Oh, wow. The first thing I'm thinking about all the work that you do and all the different projects you have is, how did you find time to write a novel?
Well, the novel took me 15 years. So it when you have 15 years, you have time to do anything. So that's how it all began. 15 years ago, when I first met my husband, he asked me if I wanted to write a screenplay with him. Mm-hmm. And I had never been a writer. I've never even contemplated writing before. I was in a graduate program doing cancer research, and you know, I wrote technical stuff, but nothing that would be creative. So when he asked me that, I was like, oh, sure, that would be fun. And we wrote this screenplay, which later turned to this novel, A Girl Called Rumi. And, you know, we wanted to kind of bring elements of the Iranian myths into it and magical realism. And we read the screenplay and we entered it into a few contests and we got into the, you know, finals or semifinals or quarterfinals. And then we put it aside. And then in 2017, when the Muslim ban happened and, you know, there were just lots of people were hungry for stories about the Middle East. I became compelled to write this. So that's when I turned the screenplay and I just kind of took, you know, just expanded on the plot and the writing and yeah, and that's when I wrote it as a book.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, you often hear of novels being sort of transferred to screenplay, but you rarely hear of it kind of going in the other direction, you know, taking something as, you know, bare bones as a screenplay where a lot of the fleshing out is, you know, on the screen and what you build there visually, but instead now you're having to flesh it out, like you mentioned, on the page since we don't have that visual element, which is really interesting to me. And your book, I mean, there's so much I want to mention about your book. So A Girl Called Rumi, one of the interesting things you do with it, it takes place at a few different time periods and with a few different point of view characters, but it's very centered in many ways around the Iranian Revolution. And for me, as someone who is Indian American, you know, entrenched in a lot of that literature, I was fairly unfamiliar with the Iranian Revolution. I think I've read only a couple of books by Iranians and Iranian Americans. And so I feel that maybe a lot of my listeners and a lot of your readers might be similar, where this is a conflict they don't know a lot about, even though America played such a role in this conflict. And so I guess my broader question is, if we were to gather a few things about, you know, such a difficult time as this political conflict and the war that resulted, what's one thing you would want your audience to understand about this historical happening?
Wow, to distill it in one thing. Well, I would say that it's all very complicated. You know, there's not one isolated incident that results a tide change and an extreme bloody revolution. There are many hands involved, and you know, the women's rights was one of the things. Like when I was six, the Islamic Republic kind of took over the revolution. I mean, before there were so many different factions that wanted to, you know, they were anti-corruption and they wanted to, they maybe wanted more democracy. Some of them were into communism, and then there was the Islamists. And what happened is that the Islamists won and they curtailed freedom of expression and cut women's rights. So that internal turmoil, when we're all trying to fight our government, then Saddam took advantage of it, Saddam Hussein, and just attacked Iran and started a war that lasted 8 years and took countless lives.
Right. And one of the things, even if you don't know a lot about this conflict, reading your book, it's evident. I mean, it's obviously fictionalized and the conflict is, you know, sort of made for fiction for the purposes of the book. But you realize just how complicated this is. And even if you're opposing some of the restrictions placed by the Islamist government, that doesn't mean you're a proponent of what America was doing. There's so much nuance to it, which we can pick up definitely on the page there, which I think is really hard to do with fiction. It's easy to make it look black and white.
Mm-hmm. True. And I've written a number of op-eds, and I've seen that kind of people saying, oh, see, that government is just so brutal, so terrible to people. So the only thing we can do is attack them. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, don't use my words to start a war with Iran, because that's not what I'm championing at all.
Absolutely. And one thing that's just so interesting, and it's something that The Enchanted does as well, that we're going to talk about, is you manage to bring an immense amount of beauty to these difficult concepts by bringing in some of the magical realism elements and bringing in some of the myth in your case. And so I was really drawn to the role of Rumi in this book, as well as evidently from a lot of the work you do. Can you speak to a little bit about what it is about Rumi that inspires you, motivates you? What is the role of Rumi in a lot of your creative work?
I think what happened, well, first of all, I was born in Shiraz, Iran, and it's the city of poets and wine. So we use poetry not just at weddings and funerals, but in conversation, in resolving conflicts, in every aspect of our lives. It was just the words of Hafez, Rumi, Saadi, Ferdowsi, all of these poets were part of our daily lives. And when I arrived in the U.S. without my parents at the age of 14, it was a sink or swim situation. I was thrown into this strange planet. I didn't speak English, so I spent so much time to assimilate and not succumb to homesickness and depression. So I was so busy fitting in and ridding myself of any trace of otherness that would exclude me. And poetry kind of became a vestigial organ. I had no use for it. And then it was a decade later when it felt like a long lost beloved was tugging on me. And it was kind of like this seeping into the tiny cracks, but widening cracks of the shell I had built around myself. So just to survive. And so it was Rumi. And I was surprised that it was Rumi, because I had grown up with Hafez, who was also born in Shiraz, and with Saadi, who was also born in Shiraz. And I had, you know, memorized so many ghazals from Hafez, and I was so in love with him. And then, but it was Rumi that I picked up, and I was like, oh my God, this is... His words are such a bridge between my current state and my past. And so that's how everything shifted. I still absolutely adore Hafez, but it was Rumi that brought me to that sense of integration of the past and the present.
That's so beautiful. I love that you felt like this tug from a beloved, the way you were describing it. Even that, you know, your description of poetry is poetry, which is, it's so beautiful. And another thing you really bring into this book, which I really admired, is the attention to detail with, you know, showing us meanings of words that you bring in from Farsi, and, you know, interpreting these myths for us. And then another thing is you pay a lot of attention to how you're translating a lot of the poetry. And you talk about how there aren't these gendered articles or a gendered pronoun so much, and you have to sort of take some interpretations or, you know, use punctuation in certain ways that might not be true to the original language. And I feel that Rumi is one of those poets that we kind of see, you know, loose translations of his work everywhere in English. Do you think it's really possible to understand and appreciate a poet when you're reading them in translation, or is it just a matter of finding a really excellent translation?
I was talking to another Persian translator of Rumi and Hafez and Persian poetry, and one of the things that we both agreed on is I translate Rumi or these poems in a different way depending on what's going on in my life at the moment. And so like I see an older translation, I'm like, I can't relate to this at all. This is how I would translate it now. So this is how, you know, then the way that I describe it, it's kind of like if you've never seen the sunset at the beach, at the sea, And you never have, and you've never seen any pictures of it. And you have several people who are artists, and they go and they start painting this image. And it all depends on how they're feeling, what their skill level is, what their style is. Are they abstract artists? Are they realists? And then they finally come and they say, okay, this is the sunset at the beach, you know? Mm-hmm. And if you've never seen it before, then you have to take their picture, not their word, for it. But so it's similar with translation, you know, it can never replace being right there, feeling the breeze and the sand under your feet and looking at the majesty of the sunset on the beach. So yeah, the translation is always a tricky business. But I think a lot of the American translators who don't speak Farsi, what happens is that they look at one of these paintings and then they describe it. So it's even more removed than the original.
I see. You're not capturing the rhythm of the prose or, you know, what was actually used in trying to depict what you're seeing rather than the words that are there on the page.
Yeah. And if you don't speak Farsi, it seems really bizarre to me to say I'm a translator. So I think that's the minimum qualification for translation, to speak the language in which you're translating.
I'd agree with that. That seems a little ludicrous otherwise, and it's hard to imagine, you know, people can call themselves a translator if you don't know and truly understand the other language, because knowing a language is not just knowing what all the individual words mean, but understanding the context, understanding, you know, just how the words fit together. It's a lot more complicated than people give it credit for. And I mean, I don't speak Farsi. I can't speak to the quality of your translations, but judging from the extensive notes you provide in your book and the effort you really put in to explain your decisions, I mean, it seemed like very conscious, very thoughtful effort.
Yeah, and I'm not a scholar of Rumi, but my mother is. So I tapped into her wisdom as I was writing this book so much. And every time I translate, you see one sentence and holy crap, you have to know Arabic, you have to know how to play chess, you have to know the Torah, the Bible, you know, so all these different references are in just a couple of words. And if you don't know, if you're not born into a culture that understands those roots, what can you do, you know, as a translator?
Right, exactly. And I guess coming back to your book, A Girl Called Rumi, so something I was curious about is thinking about your readership. So a lot of the book takes place when your main character, I believe her name is pronounced Kimia. Kimia. It takes place sort of interspersed from when she's a child to when she's an adult. And you, often when you see a child character take, you know, quite a bit of space in a book, you wonder if this is a book geared to children or geared to a younger audience. But then obviously there's a lot of trauma that comes onto the page here, you know, trauma after the conflict for both Kimia as well as her mother and some of the other characters. How do you do you find it hard to define, you know, who your book is for? Do you feel like there's a pressure to, if you have a child character, that the book can only be for children? Do you think that's a limiting perspective?
I think I was having a talk with someone yesterday about this very subject, and they said, you know, look at it as the Kite Runner. The Kite Runner is about children in Afghanistan, and it definitely is not geared towards children. It's an adult book, so this is a little bit similar. In that way, I think maybe not the new adult would be okay, but maybe young adult might be a little. I don't know if it's appropriate for a young adult or not, honestly.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't even think of the, because I personally don't feel, you know, at first when you're introduced to a child character, you might think it's for a younger audience, but reading your book, you realize, no, this is for an adult audience, maybe new adult, like you mentioned, but you're absolutely right. No one would pretend to say that The Kite Runner is a book for children, even though the characters are children. And I think it just draws into perspective that children too experience trauma, and children too are victims of war and conflict. We see it today all the time, all over the world. And if you think that's something we have to shield child characters from, then you're ignoring the real events going on in the world.
Exactly. Yeah, thank you for saying that. That's so true.
Absolutely. And so thinking about your writing in general, so you said this book, you know, it was a labor of love. It took about 15 years to come together. I'm curious to know who you draw upon as some influences. Were there Iranian writers you drew from, writers from other backgrounds? I'm wondering, you know, who inspired you?
I don't know if I had if I can pinpoint it to any specific people, because what came to me, like I in 2017 when I wrote the first draft, it kind of all came in a in maybe in a month. I wrote 80,000 words in a month or so. So it was it was kind of like, this is a story that needs to be told. And it was very much like that. I do admire so many authors, both, you know, American, Persian, and other authors who I really admire. And maybe a couple of years before the book was published, I read Shahriyar Mandalipour's and it's called, I think, a Censored Love Story. It was remarkable. I loved it so much.
I haven't read that one. I want to check it out because I was reading your book, and you know, when you've only read a couple books by writers from Iran or Persian writers, you it's so tempting to draw those comparisons, but your books is unique, and I found more similarities to, you know, books like The Kite Runner, like you mentioned, or a book that came out recently, The Parted Earth by Anjali Engetti. I found those to be more familiar to me related to your work than, you know, just the other Iranian writers I might have read. So I think it's really important to see books for what they are and not just the background the writer comes from.
I agree, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the things I was really interested by is reading your book. One of the people you acknowledge is the author of The Enchanted, Renée Denfeld. You have a really touching acknowledgement to her. And so I'm interested in transitioning over to that book. How did you first find The Enchanted? What were your initial thoughts when you read it?
I kept seeing The Enchanted everywhere when I first read it, and it just blew me away at the first, you know, passage when I got into it. I think the main character, the narrator, is talking about how you know, like it's an unreliable narrator, but talks about that this is an enchanted place. Others don't see it, but I do. And that's the first sentence. And I was very much drawn in from the beginning. And it's such a dark, terrible subject, you know,
It is.
the state of prison system narrated through the eyes of a death row inmate. Sounds so super depressing. But I was, as soon as, you know, he begins speaking, and he's mute, which also another beautiful twist to the whole thing. I was pulled into a timelessness and enchantment that can endure the worst of circumstances.
Yeah, that's certainly a highlight of this book as well. So to give everyone some background on this book, if you hadn't heard of it before, I hadn't. This is a book, I believe it came out in 2014, The Enchanted by Renée Denfeld. And like Ari mentioned, this book takes place in the underground of a state prison and features inmates on death row. And the book is exactly as dark as it sounds. The subject matter, I want to caution all of my listeners. There are some content warnings here: sexual assault, child sexual abuse, murder. There's quite a lot going on in this book. It's an incredibly dark topic. But I think something that really, I had these mixed, complicated feelings on Denfeld's writing style. You're right. She adds like this tremendous lyrical verbal beauty to the work. But at the same time, it's just at times hard to reconcile that with the terribleness of the subject matter.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So that I have talked to. So my to give you a little bit of background of how I came to know Renee was I read that book, and at the same time, a writer's group was offering mentorships by different writers, you know, established wonderful writers. And so I applied, and I saw that she was a one of the mentors, and I was like, oh my God, that would be amazing if she could mentor me. And and out of, you know, so many applications, hundreds of applications that she received, she chose my novel because of that sense of magic that is present in the very dark times. I think that's what drew her. And so yeah, she's definitely someone who really helped me ground my voice in the novel. And so when we chose it as a book club read, The Enchanted, the book club that I have, that I'm part of. And some people had that reaction. Exactly. It's like, this is so, it's really hard to swallow. It's very, very dark and depressing. And my response was like, wow, I felt so uplifted by her writing, you know, like just to be able to read about such terrible subjects. I would not have been able to read it had it not been for her writing, because it's her, this the style of writing and storytelling was both medicine and also the sweetness that would help me swallow the medicine. So yeah,
absolutely, that's such a good way to put it, because I think that puts it better than I could. Sometimes I often say, you know, and Renee Denfeld, to give some context, she has worked as a death penalty investigator, and one of the central characters in this book is also a death penalty investigator. And there's a tremendous amount of empathy and honesty that she brings to this storytelling. She doesn't shy away from the details, and this book gets very graphic at parts, but she is able to elevate some of that subject material in a way that I feel like if you had written this whole book as nonfiction, it would be very hard to stomach and very hard to read. But by putting it as fiction and with her lyrical writing, it's still able to have an impact on us, but we find ourselves moving through the story. I read this book, I'll be honest, in about a day. I finished this book in one day. Wow. And I was just so drawn into the narrative, and it's a short novel. It moves at a wonderful pace. And despite the subject matter, I even though I was troubled at points, I just couldn't look away.
Yes, yes. It does have that enchantment just woven in through the story. And that's kind of, we become enchanted as we read this. And Margaret Atwood had very wonderful things to say about the book also. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
So yeah, it's not just us, you know, some of the greats are also.
Right. Really. And Margaret Atwood, that's a great reference to bring in, because she also, you know, writes about these very difficult subject matters, and but puts it in that realm of fiction. You think of something like The Handmaid's Tale, which is it's a complete dystopia, but she's able to render that in fiction and with her writing, and it comes alive. And so you see those connections here. And so I think, you know, a good transitional point here is to talk a little bit about some of the characters Denfeld brings in. So like in your book, Ari, she focuses on a few different point of view characters. We have, as you mentioned, one of the inmates who is mute, and he sort of narrates the events going on from kind of an outside perspective. And then we have the lady. That's all she's known by. She's a death penalty investigator. She devotes herself to removing inmates from death row. And then we have another character who's described only as a fallen priest. And he's sort of left to administer rites to those right about to die. And she's able to sort of intersect all of these characters and give us this larger statement about humanity. And I think for me, if I was to focus on a character, I think the lady was probably, her sections were the most compelling to me because there was just that authenticity there. She brought this wonderful perspective where it was an outside looking in on the inmate's plight. And she brings in her own history, her own traumas that she's faced. And having her just try to devote herself to these individuals and see the humanity in them, I thought that was just very compelling to read the sections that were in her point of view especially.
Absolutely, yeah. And just this, you know, because of years of work that she has devoted, Renee Denfeld has devoted as a investigator, it really does ground the book in certain realities of our carceral system, you know, who mm-hmm. the justice system deems deserving of capital punishment, and, yeah. and the complexities of each situation, like the abuse that has created certain individuals, and whether we should just give up or fight for the lives of inmates who don't want to be saved, for example. You know?
Right. And I mean, it's very easy to read this book as, you know, very surface level, say it's anti-death penalty propaganda or what you will. If you look at some of the one-star reviews of this book, that's kind of the surface level commentary that's gave. It's like, oh, you know, this is anti-death penalty, very cut and dry. But I don't think so. This book is very nuanced in its critiques. It kind of made me question a few of my own beliefs, my relationship to the death penalty has changed a lot over the years. It's commenting on a very flawed justice system. And you're exactly right. Who is being placed on death row? For what reasons? Are these people treated as human beings? And as we learn in this book, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. And there's just so much corruption inherent to the system that you're left to wonder, can we make the judgment call that someone deserves to die? But then on the flip side, there are evil people among us who do terrible things. And this book has several characters who do terrible things. And I think the bottom line to take from this is that this isn't propaganda. It's fiction. It's beautifully written fiction. It comes from experience, but fiction on its own can't and shouldn't be, you know, guiding policy. It can just make you think about things in different ways. And I think, you know, reading fiction, it can open your mind, but it shouldn't change your mind one way or the other.
Right. It's that's what I really love about fiction, is that it can just go in and give so many nuances that is so hard to provide in, because you're in so many different perspectives, you know, like you got a warden in this book who's a really kind-hearted man and whose wife is dying of cancer. And then we would think that everyone would be like just black and white, the warden would be corrupt, but then it wasn't. He's a really sweet guy. And then right. Conroy is like the officer who's terrible. And
right. He's a sadistic character, to say the least, and in many ways just as bad as some of the inmates under his care.
Right. And then the whole thing that we think that those who commit child abuse, they do get really terrible karma coming back at them in prison, but that's not in reality, that's not the case. Some of them end up being at the top of the food chain and even doling out more abuse and punishment. So that was absolutely fascinating to me.
Yeah, you think it's this very clear hierarchy, and that's kind of a picture we get in the media, that it's like, oh, you know, the child molesters, they're the ones who really get it in prison. But that's not the case. You know, there's victimization continues, and we see that for sure in this book. But there were so many characters she managed to bring to life that it was hard for me to levy criticism of any of them. I think the one character that didn't work for me was our inmate, who narrates much of the book. Mm-hmm. His point of view, like his status as a point of view character, it unnerved me in a way that I think I need to sit with it more and to really articulate why. But for me, you know, we're given a lot of his backstory. His perspective is clearly, as you mentioned, unreliable. It's compromised in many ways. We get to know the kind of life he's led before, and we come to know of some of his crimes. But I kept wondering, you know, can the author take that perspective and do that perspective in an authentic way? I don't think any harm was meant by that kind of character being a point of view character, but I guess I just wondered, is this romanticizing certain aspects, or would the story have been stronger if she had kept it to the point of view of the lady? Those are the questions that just kept coming to mind for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. And I saw, again, as you kind of perused some of the reviews, I saw that that was kind of not something that people, it was unsettling for many people. And what I think what happens with such tremendous amount of abuse and the coping mechanism that kicks in through the escaping into the fantasy world, it really kind of breaks it all open to me. That's what, yeah. That's why this perspective works for me, is that, you know, he is narrating things that he could never know. and he's commenting on things that are so nuanced, but yeah, that just, that's, to me, is the power of stories and how we tell a new story. And every time something happens, you know, we have the capacity to tell stories and tap into the magic and the fantasy that is not available to us in our current conditions, but is unlimited in another realm. So that's how I was able to really enjoy the narrator.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think it goes in nicely to the other part of this book that I'm still kind of grappling with. And that was the inclusion of some of the more magical elements. And it's interesting because starting this book and you read those first couple of lines where this is an enchanted place and you have a title like The Enchanted, you think this is almost going to be a work of fantasy, and it's not. It's very steeped in the real and in the literal, but there are some of these magical realism elements that make their way into the book. And I love magical realism as a genre. I think it's a beautiful genre, and there's so much that you can elevate when that's done correctly. I just kept wondering, like, so much of this book was so literal and so real. We talk about, like, the graphic elements of things like syphilis and just abuse and the prison and justice system and, you know, gang violence and things that are very, very real and of our world. And then we are supposed to sort of take a step back and have some suspension of disbelief for some of the, you know, fantastical elements, which are sort of broad strokes compared to the very specific details we have. And I guess I'm still trying to process if that really worked for me. To me, it just kind of felt a little off balance, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that to me, the magical elements, like, what were they?
The flibbertigibbets, yeah.
And the golden horses, yeah. Like, I could just see, you know, be in that mindset of a person whose whole life is in a small cubicle, a small cell, and they hear stuff. So when they hear stuff in the walls, they, you know, imagine, you know, tap into the fantasy that it's these little men with hammers in the walls. It could be like rats or what could be. And then the horses would be every time an execution happens, maybe it's the electricity that jolts the whole place, because it's just such a worn down old building, this prison. And that that tremor that he feels, like he's like, oh, that just sounds like horses that would be running through, you know. And so yeah, that's how I see that when you're so sensory deprived for so long, that your imagination would create these elements.
That's a really good point, because if you think about our inmate character, it's shown, if we're given some of his backstory, that he has basically lived isolated his entire life. He pretty much never had a chance due to, you know, early child abuse, being in an institution, and then in prison. He's committed terrible crimes, but he's also in prison and never really had a chance on the outside. And a lot of his ideas of what the world outside looks like are from books and from his imagination and from some of his own delusions and things like that. So having him as a character, it anchors some of those magical elements. And so the two kind of go hand in hand. I can definitely see it that way. I think overall, you know, if I was to summarize this book, I think I just need to sit with it more. I need to think about it. I think this is a book I'm going to remember for a long time. I admire the prose. I admire the earnestness that Denfeld brought into this. I don't know if I could say I love this book. I think this is a hard book to love, but there's a lot I'm going to remember.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's such a unique book in my world that I was just floored by it.
Yeah. And that leads in nicely. I know before we started this and I mentioned, you know, normally we like to offer another recommendation for a book. And you said, you know, I can't think of another book that's quite like this one. And I am so tempted to agree. The book I came up with is more capturing its stylistics than anything else. But Ari, if you could pick a book, maybe not in lines with The Enchanted, but another book you really love and admire that you'd recommend to our listeners, what book would that be?
I think we were touching on this idea of, you know, the pro-death penalty, anti-death penalty, whether this is where it oscillates. And it reminded me of the book Cider House Rules.
Yes.
So much. I mean, it's the style of writing is completely, completely different.
Right.
But what isn't is the is that, you know, showing all the nuances of abortion and how
right.
women come to do such a thing. So that, and I love that book so much by John Irving.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've read The Cider House Rules, but you're exactly right. It's a complicated, nuanced look at a very controversial topic and trying to delve into the stories of people who choose that decision and why. Just gives you another way of thinking. It's not meant as propaganda, but just to give you another perspective you may not have considered.
Exactly, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's a really great recommendation for sure. I think I was sort of influenced by the writing style when I thought of the recommendation. And also one of the writers that blurbed The Enchanted was Aaron Morgenstern. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking of Aaron Morgenstern's book, The Night Circus,
yes.
Which very, very different in terms of content. You know, it's much more fantastical, you know, much lighter in terms of content, but we do see that similar descriptive writing, that beautiful lyrical prose, that very strong sense of place. I think that really comes alive in The Night Circus. I think I definitely preferred The Enchanted to The Night Circus because The Enchanted has more of a plot. It definitely moves at a much better pace than The Night Circus does. But if you're a fan of truly lyrical prose and evocative settings, that might be a good book to pick up.
Mm-hmm. And another author, speaking of lyrical, who I really loved, she was born in the Iran prison, Evin, one of the most notorious political prisons in the world. And she's just, her writing is absolutely gorgeous. And her name is Sahar Dilijani. And her book is The Children of Jacaranda Tree.
Mm.
And that's just really, really beautiful writing. It came out a few years ago, and it's been translated to, I don't know, 70 languages.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I'm going to have to pick that up. Because one thing your book, you know, brought to mind is this is a bit of a blind spot in my own reading. There's so little I know about this part of the world, and reading, you know, own voices books by writers from that region is now something I really want to do. And so I really appreciate that recommendation. I urge you all to check out The Enchanted, to check out A Girl Called Rumi, which is out shortly. Ari, could you tell us a little bit about where we can find you and find your work?
Sure. I'm at rumiwithaview.com, and you can send me a note. I would love to hear from everyone. I'm also on social media. So, yeah.
And everyone, keep an eye out for A Girl Called Rumi. Ari, when does your book come out in the world?
It comes out on September 21st. So, and it's the anniversary of the Iran-Iraq War.
Oh, wow. Did you plan that accordingly?
Yes.
That's a wonderful conscious thought. And so I urge you all to check it out. If this is a part of your reading that you want to expand, or if you're just a fan of a really wonderful magical realism story, I think you'll really enjoy this book. Ari, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm so happy we had this beautiful conversation.